KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Good morning. A longtime supporter of President Trump is pushing for even more radical change. What does a conversation with Steve Bannon tell us about where a part of Trump's coalition is going? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Republicans in Congress have less than a month to hit their goal of passing a budget. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. They don't have many votes to give up in the House or Senate, but there are big differences in each chamber's plan. Also, the latest data on how the economy is doing and how a UFO watchtower turned from joke to genuine roadside attraction. It's Wednesday, April 30th. The first TV ad for a toy aired today in 1952 for Mr. Potato Head with the confusing tagline, "Any fruit or vegetable makes a funny face man."
What? Well, why not Mr. Broccoli then?
True. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened lower this morning as the Commerce Department reported a drop in economic output during the first 3 months of this year. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled nearly 700 points in early trading.
It's not the economic report card the Trump administration was hoping for. As the president marks 100 days in office this week, the nation's gross domestic product shrank at an annual rate of 0.3% during the first quarter. That drop was largely driven by a surge of imports as businesses and consumers raced to stock up before the president's tariffs took effect. Imports are a negative for GDP. Personal spending, which is the biggest driver of economic activity, grew less than half as fast as during the previous quarter. Other economic scorecards are also flashing warning signs. The S&P 500 index is down sharply since Inauguration Day, and consumer confidence has fallen to its lowest level since the start of the pandemic. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Trump is apparently blaming former President Joe Biden for the poor economic report. Writing online, Trump says, quote, "This will take a while, has nothing to do with tariffs." Trump also tells people to, quote, "be patient," followed by three exclamation points. Trump had a more direct message for his fans last night near Detroit. At a rally, he celebrated his first 100 days in office.
"This is the best, they say, 100-day start of any president in history, and everyone is saying it. We've just gotten started. You haven't even seen anything yet. It's all just kicking in."
In his first 100 days, Trump has signed scores of executive orders. He's fired hundreds of thousands of federal workers, slashed DEI efforts, and infuriated foreign allies. Trump supporters say he is taking the steps that they want, but polling of Americans suggests falling support for the president. The U.S. Supreme Court will tackle a knotty conflict between church and state today. At issue is a test case from Oklahoma. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports it is over whether overtly religious schools may also be publicly funded charter schools.
On one side of the case are two Catholic dioceses in Oklahoma. Representing them is lawyer James Campbell.
"You can't create a public program and then just simply say that no religious organization can apply."
On the other side is the state's Republican Attorney General, Gentner Drummond.
"Religious liberty is really the freedom to worship. It is not taxpayer-funded, state-sponsored religious indoctrination."
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The House is expected to vote today on a Republican effort to get rid of a California plan to block most sales of gasoline-powered cars by the year 2035. The plan had been approved by the EPA under former President Biden. California officials say they need this to cut greenhouse gas emissions. You're listening to NPR News. In Southern California, thousands of union employees of Los Angeles County are expected to continue their strike today. Members of the Service Employees International Union are walking out for 48 hours. Steve Futterman reports they want to bring attention to the collapse of contract talks.
On day two, numerous county services will again be impacted, including libraries, parks, and non-urgent health clinics. With so many workers out, many county offices are at a standstill. On Tuesday, thousands took to the streets to march and take part in a rally. One of those speaking was Eloy Alvarez.
"Are we not going to take it anymore? Are we going to stand up and fight?"
The union wants higher wages. The county says the union demands are not sustainable. This is just a two-day walkout, but the union warns there could be similar and lengthier actions if substantive progress isn't made. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The state of Florida is poised to ban fluoride from its public water systems. Utah has already done this. Opponents say fluoride is endorsed by medical professionals as a public health achievement that prevents tooth decay. Scientists say they've discovered an invisible molecular cloud of gas not that far from Earth. It would seem gigantic in the night sky if we could see it. Scientists say molecules in the gas cloud can collapse, and if they do, they can form baby stars. Scientists picked up on this find when they scoured the sky with special equipment to read ultraviolet light. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR Nations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Think or Swim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Stephen K. Bannon expects a busy summer.
There's going to be a confrontation. I think the convergence, particularly of spending cuts, and the simultaneously constitutional crisis that we're hurtling to, is going to make this summer a summer like no other.
So he predicted when we sat down to talk this week. Bannon is a sometime advisor to President Trump who promoted his cause in 2016, worked in the White House for a while, and now spends 4 hours per day doing a live stream video program that is also a podcast.
War Room. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Okay, it's Monday, 28 April, year of our Lord, 2025.
He puts out hours of programming that people follow when trying to understand a wide swath of Trump supporters.
Bannon has understood the MAGA voter better than basically anybody on the right.
Tim Miller is a former Republican strategist and writer.
The language that he uses, the policy positions that he takes, are kind of a window into where the Republican Party is going.
We visited Bannon at the studio where he broadcasts, the basement of a Washington, D.C. townhouse. It's filled with books and newspapers. When we last visited, just before the inauguration, he was broadcasting in front of a mantle covered with Christian icons and slogans. When we came by 100 days later, the mantle had a few additions, signs reading, "God will not be mocked," and "We can do hard things."
We got to start making things again. The high value added part of manufacturing has to come back. Something that a man or a woman can have a job and have a family and have their spouse stay home if they so want and raise their kids. Once we're back to that, the country's going to be vibrant and robust again.
Bannon describes a return to an older economy, which is connected with a more traditional idea of the family. He sees that distant goal amid the trade war, the firing of government employees, and a drive to deport as many people as possible, all of which he discussed in a characteristically expansive conversation about the first 100 days.
It's a revolution about America's role in the world, our position geopolitically, the global commercial relationships, plus the administrative state and how the country's governed. He's so much farther down the path than and so much more aggressive than I think anybody would ever thought.
Certainly a lot of attention, but help me understand how much has really changed. I've heard you talk about government spending. Doge has gotten a lot of attention. Elon Musk has a lot of attention. Analysts have said the actual savings are not that great. It might end up costing the government something.
Well, first off, I do think, and I've had tremendous disagreements with Elon Musk, I do believe you had to have a trauma-inducing force like Doge to kind of rattle the administrative state. I think they really served a purpose. Now, to the degree that they find actual $1 trillion, which I was always skeptical about, in waste and fraud, but there will be something. I've actually called for an audit of that. Number two, there also has to be a certification that no data or data sets of American citizens have gone anywhere except to the Trump administration and or the U.S. government.
You have doubts?
Trust, but verify.
When you listen to Steve Bannon, you hear some of the debates within Trump's coalition. Bannon is focused on government debt. He wants to reduce spending, even military spending, which Republicans traditionally support. He says he personally would raise taxes on the wealthy, and he's hoping that Trump's trade war eventually restores those high-paying jobs for the working class. What have you thought about as the president imposed tariffs on China, raised the tariffs on China dramatically, then backed off on key products, and then talked about making a deal with China even though there's been negotiations? Why do you think he changed so much?
Well, number one, I think we started a process with the nations of East Asia. You have Japan, you have South Korea, you have Taiwan, Philippines, Vietnam, and now India, all in discussions around a basic architecture that kind of stacked up for Bessent to get these deals done, or at least to get the architecture of it done, not the actual finished deals, but the
terms. Yeah, we have no deals yet that we know.
Well, but you do have, I think this week, they're talking about maybe two or three memorandums of understanding on the architecture of it. But President Trump went in full force. He's got his own negotiating style. I think he's been quite smart about how to do this. And he's obviously wants to make sure that the store shelves are not totally empty. I mean, as of yesterday, we have a full embargo on Chinese goods.
Except for consumer electronics, iPhones, anything that consider
well,
truly
yeah,
valuable.
Some of that's starting to come through as we alleviate somewhat.
Does he look weak by changing all the time?
I don't think he looks weak. I think he looks like a very smart deal guy trying to move the chess pieces, right?
When we visited Steve Bannon at the start of this week, he had just finished his morning webcast. He spent parts of it pressing the president to go even further than Trump has.
Here's what I would do with Harvard. And I don't think President Trump's being hard enough. First off, I would...
Bannon has a Harvard MBA and made money on Wall Street and in Hollywood, but now speaks out against the elites. He wants the government to target top private and public universities.
I give him a list of 200 faculty members and 200 administrators. We're cutting off all federal money until they're gone. Once they're gone, we'll start bleeding it back in. And oh, by the way, all 350,000 Chinese nationals, students that are here in the country, got to leave immediately.
Bannon talks of expelling all these students who pay billions of dollars per year in tuition to American universities. His allegation is that they take away U.S. research. It's a position that fits his broader support for deporting people in the U.S. without legal status. Clearly, you're in favor of mass deportations, and the president has made some high-profile moves in that direction. And has run up against judicial resistance, including from people appointed by the president.
A judicial insurrection.
You've got a judge. Okay, but wait. You have a unanimous Supreme Court saying all nine of us agree there should be some kind of due process. It might not be a full trial, but somebody should be brought before a judge before they're thrown out of the country. You have a U.S. citizen who was 2 years old taken out of the country, and a Trump-appointed judge said the other day there was no meaningful process. Does it bother you at all, as an American citizen, that due process is not being followed in some cases?
It bothers me that a court, there's nowhere in the Constitution talks about judicial supremacy. Nowhere in the Constitution talks about judicial supremacy. What you're seeing is a court trying to step between President Trump and his...
Isn't it just a court checking it against the law to say that's illegal,
not legal? They're stepping in the middle of President Trump and the unitary theory of the executive, or Article II, his role as commander-in-chief. This happened before in our country. It's happened a couple times. A guy named Abraham Lincoln,
Bannon, who loves history, began telling a story about the Civil War president. Lincoln sometimes exercised the government's power to detain people without charges during a rebellion. He defied the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who said that only Congress could allow this. Congress later did. Bannon insists on a parallel in dealing with immigrants.
If every one of these criminal terrorists have due process, it's 200 years before they get out. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. The American people back Trump on this, and they have to go, and they're going to go.
And the argument against due process is just that it's inconvenient. It would take too much time for millions
of people. It's not about the convenience thing is one, but it's just you don't need it. It's not necessary. It's time of war, and they're going to leave.
Let me ask about another thing, though. Having to do with the Constitution and tariffs. This is another instance where the president says, there's an emergency, I'm going to raise taxes, tomorrow I'm going to lower taxes.
Tariffs.
Okay, if you want to call them tariffs, I'm going to raise them, I'm going to lower them, I'm going to raise
them. Did you call them taxes?
They are taxes paid by Americans, according to economists. In any event, whatever we call them, Americans seem to pay them when the imports are brought in. The president has asserted the right to massively affect the economy and then change it again today and hours later, without consulting Congress, because he says it's an emergency. It's gone so far that some Republicans in Congress are trying to reclaim their power. Does it concern you at all that a president could claim the power to completely transform the economy all by himself, just on his say-so?
Well, it's not just on his say-so. It is, he did execute emergency powers to do this, given the emergency that's there, both on fentanyl and on the national security.
But the emergency is, he says there's an emergency. That's all there is.
No, he gave backup document to on the fentanyl issue. And also
Canada?
And the deficits alone. The trade deficit's $25 trillion, brother. That's not an emergency.
The United States does have an annual trade deficit with other nations, which the Trump White House estimates at $1.2 trillion last year. We buy more stuff than we sell. It's often balanced by foreign investments in the United States.
And that's not a bookkeeping thing that the Wall Street guys say. Mm-hmm. That's resources that went to us, to other countries, $18 trillion to China.
Granted, everything you say, would it be possible to work it through Congress? Just to pass a bill, do the constitutional thing?
He's called for emergency measures. If Congress had been doing its job on trade and tariffs over the last, let me just guess, I don't know, since they allowed China to come in as a World Trade Organization, they would have some backup from people say, yeah, you know, we should get Congress in here because they've done such a great job. What has Congress done? The House and Senate have rolled over to the globalists for 30 or 40 years. Pardon me if I don't take their concerns when somebody steps up and says, hey, look, I'm going to put America and I'm going to put American citizens first.
You're no more confident in this Republican Congress than in past ones?
Good God, no. I mean, look at with Johnson as Speaker.
Bannon has been watching Speaker Mike Johnson's House Republican Conference and its effort to pass a single giant spending bill as the president wants. It involves more borrowing than Bannon would like.
No, the last one, we were very proud that we turfed out. This show was the leader in turfing out McCarthy. Johnson, I think, may actually be worse because I think he's tapped along the president. Everything I've seen coming from this conference so far about the big, beautiful deal looks like fiscal insanity.
Steve Bannon, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Steve, always great having you here in the War Room.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there, Steve.
Yeah, it was a long discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think my question as I was listening was, what does he make of these disapproval ratings, the lowest in 80 years since in the first 100 days?
Lowest other than Trump's first term, of course. Yeah, Trump's approval has gone way down in survey after survey. Bannon essentially in our conversation denied the whole thing. He said, I just don't believe it. I don't buy it. I think it's a media psyop. And he is pushing ahead and wants Trump to go further than he has. The interview with Steve Bannon was a lot longer. It's on video. You can find the video on the NPR app or at npr.org or on our YouTube channel. And this interview is part of an NPR News special report on Trump's first 100 days in office. That's on the radio, hosted by Michelle Martin. And you can hear that on many NPR stations this evening. This is NPR News.
A once fringe movement to increase birth rates is exploding into the mainstream, but it's not just about having more babies. On the next Fresh Air, we'll explore the politics of pronatalism, from Elon Musk's crusade against population collapse to ideas about genetic engineering and the so-called Great Replacement. We'll speak to NPR's Lisa Hagen and demographer Karen Guzzo. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. As President Trump marks his 100th day in office, we have signs of the U.S. economy moving in the wrong direction. New figures from the Commerce Department this morning show the U.S. economy shrank in the first 3 months of the year. Not a lot, but it shrank. The stock market has dropped sharply since Inauguration Day, and consumer confidence has fallen to its lowest level since the beginning of the pandemic years ago. NPR's Scott Horsley is following all of this. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What happened?
This is all about the president's trade war, which has been really disruptive both around the world and here at home. Taxes on imports are now the highest they've been since at least the Great Depression. That's triggered a big sell-off in the stock market. And Americans are telling pollsters they're really pessimistic and think we could be headed for a recession. Mark Zandi, who's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, says this is a flashing red sign for the White House.
I think recession's dead ahead unless we can find a way to get off the tariff road and bring down the tensions in global trade quickly. We don't have months here, we have weeks, because it just feels like the economy's seizing up and, you know, people are nervous, businesses, consumers, investors, very nervous, and I don't think it's going to take much to push us under here.
That GDP report this morning shows the U.S. economy shrank in the first 3 months of the year. That's largely because of a flood of imports as businesses and consumers tried to stock up before the tariffs took effect. Imports are a subtraction from GDP. Government spending was also down during the quarter, and consumer spending, which is the biggest driver of the U.S. economy, grew less than half as fast as it did during the waning months of the Biden administration.
I just want to mention all this is happening in some cases just weeks after some of the president's highest profile actions. Have President Trump's tariffs had any effect on prices yet?
Yes, although we're not seeing a lot of that in the data yet, which only runs through March before the big tariffs took effect. And in fact, some of the people who answered the consumer confidence survey noted they were happy to see the price of gasoline coming down thanks to a global slowdown. But there's a lot of concern that tariffs will push prices up more in the months to come if they stick. And that's a big if. The White House itself says the whopping 145% tariffs on Chinese imports might have to come down. But in the meantime, you've got a lot of shoppers and a lot of businesses that are kind of paralyzed. Kurt Carpenter sells lighting fixtures from China at a business in Boston. He says this is the toughest business has been in more than two decades.
We saw the 2008 housing crisis, but I gotta say, this may be one worse. At the end of the day, it's really just a tax on the end consumer, and it's only hurting us.
Now, Carpenter's hoping the U.S. and China will negotiate lower tariffs, but for now, he says the trade war is a tremendous burden on U.S. consumers.
You're reminding me that there are two factors here, and one is just the chaos. Tariffs up, tariffs down, tariffs sideways, tariffs uncertain, and that uncertainty is itself a big problem. But then there's just the matter of tariff policy, using tariffs as an economic instrument. Is anybody rooting for that?
Absolutely. There are some businesses that stand to benefit. Tom Barr is a mold maker in Michigan who supplies equipment to automakers and others that they use to form plastic parts. He'd been losing business to China, but says since the tariffs took effect, he's been getting phone calls from potential customers who are interested in bringing that business back home.
Somebody reached out to us from Ford Motor Company. They're investigating it. They're not saying they're going to do anything, but they want to know what their options are. So without these tariffs, those phone calls wouldn't even have taken place.
But even Barr suggests the tariffs could be more narrowly targeted to protect some businesses like his without necessarily adding a tax on everything the U.S. buys from other countries.
NPR's Scott Horsley's analysis is made in America and tariff-free. Scott, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, sometimes a joke takes on a life of its own. Like this one, from a woman in Colorado who created a roadside attraction that decades later draws about 10,000 visitors per year. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce has the story.
The San Luis Valley is a vast high desert plain ringed by sweeping mountain ranges. It's just a little bit smaller than the state of New Jersey, but only about 50,000 people live here. And back in the late 90s, Judy Messaline and her partner were out here barely getting by raising their 75 cows.
They don't eat sand real well. About broke us from having to buy the hay for them.
They weren't sure what they were going to do.
And one of the farmers came in one day and he said, "You know what? You need to put up that UFO watchtower you giggled about. You'd have fun."
People in the valley have been reporting UFO sightings since the 60s. Now, Judy, she wasn't fueled by this alien fascination or conspiracy theories. She just wanted to earn a few extra bucks.
It was a joke. That's what it was. Initially, it was a joke. And hoping to pull the tourist traffic off the highway, you know.
That was 25 years ago.
I can't believe it's been that long.
Yeah. Beside the highway, a green alien made of sheet metal points the way.
Well, I have had fun, but in the same token, we have had 304 sightings from just here.
Have you had your own proper UFO sightings, seeing anything that looks weird?
I've had 30. The closest one was between here and the mountains and part way down. I called it a cigar-shaped. It was narrow, really long, and it went zip like that.
Visitors buy Little Green Man merch in the gift shop, look through a binder packed with handwritten accounts of the UFO sightings here, and beneath the watchtower, offerings. People leave their shoes and license plates, keys, hats, in a swirling rock garden protected by two alien statues.
So I started telling people, and I don't know if it was a good idea or not, but I told them to leave something in the garden and get their energy there as well.
Judy is planning a 25th birthday party for the tower this Memorial Day. She's in the process of handing management over to her son, but you'll still find her working the weekends this summer, selling alien stuff, chatting with overnight campers.
You gotta tell them the stories, you know. You gotta entertain. That's the whole thing.
For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Hooper, Colorado.
This is NPR News.
Weeks ahead of extreme weather season in the U.S., the Trump administration canceled billions in weather disaster funding. The shift from federal to local leaves more people in small towns in harm's way.
Guys, this is dangerous. Our sewer plant is going to continue to overflow.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, staying safe with less federal support on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Stocks on Wall Street are sharply lower this morning after the Commerce Department reported the U.S. economy shrank in the first quarter. It contracted 0.3% as President Trump implemented sweeping tariffs and consumer confidence in the U.S. declined. The Conference Board says it's fallen for five consecutive months. The decline in gross domestic product is the first since 2022. Small business owners in San Francisco are among those saying they're worried about the effects of President Trump's trade war with China. Ren Farrell with member station KALW reports.
Assemblymember Matt Haney joined small business owners and members of the San Francisco Chinese Chamber of Commerce to condemn President Trump's 145% tariff on Chinese imports.
Sometimes these tariffs are framed as being about targeting foreign governments or foreign economies, but this is devastating our economy.
Megan Lee and her son Lucas Lee sell religious products. They say almost 100% of their inventory is imported from China.
Usually incense range from anywhere from $5 to $20, right? So with the current tariffs and all that's happening, we're looking at like $40, $50 for just a single bundle of incense.
Earlier this month, Governor Gavin Newsom filed a lawsuit challenging President Trump's authority to unilaterally enact tariffs. For NPR News, I'm Ren Farrell in San Francisco.
This is NPR News. The Trump administration is being sued over its efforts to dismantle AmeriCorps, the federal agency for national service and volunteering. Here's NPR's Giles Snyder.
24 states and the District of Columbia joined the lawsuit filed in federal court in Baltimore. The states allege that the Trump administration is illegally gutting the agency through the cancellation of hundreds of millions of dollars in grant funding approved by Congress and cutting a vast majority of the AmeriCorps workforce. According to the lawsuit, about 85% of AmeriCorps staff were put on administrative leave this month. When Trump took office, AmeriCorps had more than 500 employees and a budget totaling about $1 billion. The lawsuit argues President Trump does not have the constitutional authority to dismantle an agency that Congress created more than 30 years ago. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
States involved in that lawsuit include California, Illinois, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Iran's official news agency says the government has executed a man who it says spied for Israel's foreign intelligence agency. Iran says the man also played a role in the killing of a colonel in Iran's Revolutionary Guard 3 years ago. The agency says Mohsen Langeshnershin was a senior spy for the Mossad and was hanged. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 428 points, or more than 1%. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead, online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Republicans in Congress return to Washington this week after a two-week recess.
Ready to make good on President Trump's promise to pass a big bill full of his top policy priorities. In the House, they say the goal is to write these plans covering everything from taxes and immigration to spending cuts and pass it by Memorial Day, which is less than a month from now.
NPR's Elena Moore is following this, and she joins me now in studio. Hi, Elena.
Good morning.
Good morning. So Republicans have been talking about their plans to pass President Trump's agenda for some time now. Just remind us of where they are in this process.
Yeah, well, a few weeks ago, the House and the Senate approved a budget framework for this big spending bill. Now, House Republicans say they're focused on drafting and agreeing to all the pieces of the legislation based on that framework. Here's how Republican Congressman and Majority Leader Steve Scalise put it to reporters on Tuesday.
All of our committees have been meeting, both individually, we've been meeting with the president for about a year to get to this moment and start delivering on those things that we all ran on.
Yeah, and House committees are planning to release and work through their proposals for the spending bill over the next few weeks. After that, the House Budget Committee will work to put it all together so the whole House can vote. And we should say, Layla, this is entirely a partisan process, and Democrats who don't have the power to stop this are unanimously opposed.
Okay, Elena, Memorial Day is about a month away.
Yeah.
Does it seem like they will actually be able to meet this goal?
Well, Republicans want to pass a lot of policy, mm-hmm. but some of it is divisive, even among Republicans. And that's just a difficult task given their razor-thin majority. So they need to keep different factions of their conference happy. Plus, House committees have been directed to propose at least $1.5 trillion in cuts. Mm. In the Senate, they're supposed to slash just $4 billion in cuts, but they've promised to cut more.
Okay, so they're working with different numbers, but what about policy? What are the biggest divisions right now?
Well, one is over the future of Medicaid, mm-hmm. the government insurance program available for low-income Americans and folks with disabilities. It falls under the House Energy and Commerce Committee's control, and the committee is looking to propose $880 billion in cuts. Mm. And Democrats point to a recent analysis from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office to conclude that cuts to Medicaid would have to happen in order to get to that number. Still, you know, some Republicans have come out strongly against this, both in the House and in the Senate. You know, it's something Missouri Senator Josh Hawley told me he's not going to compromise on, given just how many people in his state rely on both Medicaid and the related Children's Health Insurance Program.
Some people, I think, would like to cut Medicaid. That's a goal. They view that as a feature, not a bug. I view it as a bug. I mean, I'm not going to vote for Medicaid cuts, not with 21% of my state, including a lot of kids who are getting Medicaid or CHIP.
What else are they considering?
Well, some committees have started to spell out what they would already cut. Just this week, the House Committee on Education and the Workforce released their spending proposal, which includes scrapping some current student loan repayment plans and capping how much Americans can borrow from the government. So we'll be watching how lawmakers negotiate these cuts over the next few weeks.
That's NPR's Elena Moore. Thank you, Elena.
Thanks.
The House of Representatives has blocked an inquiry into Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Strictly speaking, what happened was the House blocked itself. Adam Smith, a Democrat of Washington, wanted to look into Hegseth's use of a private messaging app to spread sensitive information about upcoming attacks in Yemen. Smith filed what's called a resolution of inquiry, which allows a member of the House to force an investigation, even when they're in the minority. Representative Smith is on the line to tell us what happened next. Mr. Smith, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
What did House Republicans do yesterday when you tried to use your power to force an investigation?
They passed a rule basically to shut off resolutions of inquiry, to not allow them, which basically frustrates the democratic process. And there's a theme there in terms of what the Trump administration has been doing all over the place. Changing the rules, not allowing open public discussion and the normal democratic process to take place. And I guess there's substance and there's process here. And the substance is they are so afraid of this issue, they can't defend it, that they don't want to talk about it. And they will go to extraordinary process lengths to try to prevent Congress from doing its job of exercising oversight over the Pentagon. And as you know from the signal story, Secretary Hegseth really needs oversight given his, you know, use of sensitive information in a way that is incredibly dangerous.
Now, there are two ways to look at this, I suppose, and one is in an institutional sense. There is Congress. You're separate from the executive branch. You're supposed to give oversight. You're supposed to defend your institution. And I think that's what you're saying you're trying to do. But let me ask about another thing. There's also the House majority, and they try to run things as much as possible. You've been in Congress a long time, including when Democrats were in the majority. Have Democrats welcomed Republican demands for investigations in the past?
Well, we've never welcomed them, but there are rules put in place so that the minority can be heard. That's part of a representative democracy, not to get into the whole Founding Fathers Constitution thing. But that was one of the things they really wanted to make sure, was that, okay, the majority controls. In the end, they will probably win if they have the votes. But you want to make sure that minority voices are heard. That's part of having a representative democracy. It's part of having people have a voice in their government. You want to allow for those debates, even if in the end you lose the vote. And what the Republicans are doing now is they're trying to shut off even the discussion and the debate. And actually, the reconciliation process was interesting. We marked up in the Armed Services Committee yesterday, mm-hmm. to your previous story. Now, in the Armed Services Committee, they gave us an extra $150 billion. So we're spending money, not cutting it. But we, on the minority side, raised a whole series of amendments about what happened with Signalgate and what Hegseth is doing. Republicans just didn't say anything and just voted them all down. They refused to even speak one time to defend Secretary Hegseth, I guess because they know he's indefensible. So they want to shut down the debate and not have the conversation. And that is really important because forget how you feel about the issue. We're America. We're a representative government. We're supposed to have the opportunity to have debate, have discussion, and they're trying to shut that down.
I just want to remember again, I mean, the majority tries to run things, and the majority that is connected with the president is going to try to protect the president to some extent. But would you make the argument that in this case, in this year, Congress is effectively neutering itself, going farther than a majority normally would to shut down debate and avoid their own institutional job to be a check on the president?
100%. This is unprecedented, the degree to which, and again, at the end of the day, we'll have the vote. And if they want to vote the way they vote, they win. That's great. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to shut down the debate. They don't want to have the conversation. And again, I will submit, it's like they know that they cannot defend Pete Hegseth, so they just want to make the entire issue go away and not allow people to talk about it, and everybody ought to be concerned about that.
Democratic Representative Adam Smith of Washington State, pleasure talking with you again. Thanks so much.
Always, thanks.
And a reminder, NPR CEO chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. This is NPR News.
Jessica Slice has been both abled and disabled. Her new book, Unfit Parent, explores the challenges and strengths of disabled parenting. More next time here and now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep with a breaking news update. Earlier this month, we told you about the roughly 100-year-old tortoise named Mommy, who became an actual mommy for the first time when four of her eggs hatched at the Philadelphia Zoo. The zoo needed to decide what to name the babies, and given that the parents are both about a century old, they went with a golden theme. The Galapagos hatchlings are now golden girls, Dorothy, Rose, Blanche, and Sophia. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. There was Barbenheimer summer, then Brat summer. So what will this year bring?
Everything you are. Everything you've done. Has come to this.
Maybe it's the new Mission Impossible movie or the return of a favorite TV show, like The Bear. Here to tell us about a few movies and shows they're excited to watch this summer is NPR pop culture correspondent Linda Holmes. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Layla.
Okay, so the movie Sinners is on everyone's mind as we enter the summer movie season. What other movies are worth a trip to the theater?
Yeah, Sinners has definitely been the big splash of the year so far. As the summer goes on, we'll see the more expected kinds of summer movies. One kind is sequels. One of the biggest of those is the one you heard there, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. That makes it sound like it's the last one, by the way, but all evidence suggests it's not, so don't take the title too literally. There are also two big superhero movies coming, one of which is a new Superman that gives that character another fresh start. The other is the Fantastic Four First Steps, which is an effort to get those characters going after a couple of false starts in the past. That one is headlined by Pedro Pascal, who's working a ton right now, so we'll see whether people go for it.
Are there any movies that you think people should really consider that aren't typical blockbusters?
Well, you know, one of the breakout movies of 2022 was Megan, a horror story about an AI-driven doll who, of course, becomes terrifyingly violent and ends up murdering a bunch of people.
Of course.
It made a lot of money. It got actually very good reviews, and now there is a sequel coming. It's called Megan 2.0. One of the few genres that continues to do really well at the box office outside of action franchises is horror, as we did see with Sinners. So I expect this one to get a lot of attention and maybe make a lot of money too.
Okay, so we've covered movies. What are you looking forward to on TV this summer?
There are a couple of new shows I'm looking forward to. One is Adults on FX, which is kind of a Gen Z hangout show of the kind they made a lot of after shows like Living Single and Friends were popular, but they don't make them as much recently, so I'm very curious to see it. The other is an HBO movie called Mountainhead, which I'm interested in because it comes from Jesse Armstrong, who was the creator of Succession. This film is also about terrible rich people, so it's something I've seen him do well before. And there are shows that are good that are coming back. The Bear is coming back. Poker Face is coming back. And if you're still following the Sex and the City universe, the sequel series, And Just Like That is coming back too.
Okay, so as I mentioned at the top, we've had Barbenheimer, Brat Summer. Is there a single theme you see that will define how this summer unfolds?
Well, you know, these kinds of themes often don't emerge until audiences get to weigh in and decide what they care about. Right now, it looks pretty safe. Lots of sequels, existing franchises and characters getting follow-ups or new beginnings. But if something is going to break out, it may be something we don't even know about yet. So that is always where my optimism lies.
That is Linda Holmes. She hosts NPR's podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Layla.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
The U.S. economy did not grow at all January to March. There's news it shrank.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, with a reminder this World Password Day that Bitwarden is designed to offer password security across all devices and accounts. Bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The government said today the U.S. economy, as measured by gross domestic product, has a negative sign in front of it, a contraction of 0.3%. The forecast had been for growth, but no, it takes not one but two quarters of contraction to make a recession, and this result has specific trade distortions built in, since the surge in imports ahead of tariffs that occurred get subtracted from GDP. The uncertainty over tariff policy is also seen as discouraging hiring, the ADP company said today. Only 62,000 more names were on payrolls for this month, half of what was expected. And Stellantis, the maker of Jeeps and Rams, says it's no longer comfortable giving guidance on its future sales and profits. Marketplace's Novosavo explains.
Stellantis had been expecting a recovery this year after profits plunged more than 60% last year and led to the ouster of its CEO. The company in February predicted growing sales. But that was before the Trump administration issued a series of tariffs that impact automakers on steel, aluminum, vehicles, and auto parts, along with country-specific tariffs. Nearly 40% of the vehicles Stellantis sells in the U.S. are imported, mostly from Canada and Mexico. The company said it's engaged with policymakers, but the uncertainties around tariffs and how they might change mean it cannot offer a forecast of what's ahead. Stellantis is not alone. General Motors took the same action yesterday, suspending its guidance, and we'll hear from Ford on Monday. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
Stock market is now in the dumps, with the Dow down 432 points, 1.1%. The S&P is down 1.4%. The NASDAQ is down 1.9%. Following pressure from the White House, Amazon has backed away from displaying the cost of tariffs on some individual products. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that.
These days, Mark Cohen, the recently retired director of retail studies at Columbia Business School, is getting a lot of phone calls from people he knows in the fashion business.
They're calling me looking for an opinion as to whether they should mark their prices as being tariff-driven. And my answer is, yes, you bet.
Because if you're a customer and you go to a store to buy something you're used to getting for $100 and it's suddenly $150,
I think you deserve an explanation.
But Cohen says businesses are torn between wanting to give that explanation and being concerned it might not go over well. Nitin Jain at Alex Partners says they have reason to be.
Because of the backlash that many retailers have seen in the recent past, retailers are conscious about not taking a political view.
But just increasing prices may cause its own backlash. Arun Sundaram at CFRA Research says some businesses may have no choice, but others, like big box retailers, are looking to avoid it.
They're trying to move sourcing out of China, for example, or work with different suppliers. A lot of them have also been buying inventory in advance.
To keep prices down, at least for now. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Gamma. Gamma uses AI to generate presentations, websites, social media, and documents from a single prompt. No design or coding skills required. More at gamma.app. You have ideas, Gamma brings them to life. And by Sold a Story, investigating how the education system got reading wrong and takes you places getting it right. Sold a Story, available in podcast apps.
To Britain, which had started taxing people on their foreign assets, some of the wealthy started talking about moving away, and now the UK government has thrown them a bone. Here's the BBC's James Graham.
For years, the UK has had a controversial tax status known as the non-dom. It's short for non-domiciled, which meant you could live in the UK, but your home for tax purposes was overseas. It's a different concept to the US, where citizens are taxed on income wherever it's earned. This has long been an emotive subject in the UK, and there was uproar in 2022 when it emerged that the then finance minister's wife, Akshata Murty, was one of 74,000 non-doms. A qualifying resident could pay a fee to nominate another country as their permanent home to avoid UK tax on worldwide income. It was widely seen as an anachronism, and both major parties had promised reforms.
I've always said that if you make Britain your home, you should pay your taxes here too.
That's the current finance minister, Rachel Reeves, setting out plans to abolish the non-dom status last October. The government said it wanted to address unfairness in the system and raise money for services, but its position did soften. Non-doms now have longer, 4 years in fact, to bring their money onshore tax-free, and after that period, taxes kick in on worldwide income. The change came after critics said wealthy people would leave the UK, and one report found numbers had risen, but those figures have been disputed. Chris Ball advises high-net-worth individuals at Hoxton Wealth. He says clients are looking at countries with more sympathetic tax policies.
I think a lot of people that this applies to are mobile and they have other options. So we're seeing people go to the Middle East, Dubai. We're seeing people look at Italy.
And Chris thinks that the US is also becoming an attractive option.
I think this administration is very pro people with money residing in the US. Our view is that they're trying to make it easier for them to come over and gain residence and gain citizenship.
One person who says she'll leave the UK is Magda Wierzycka, founder of financial services firm Signia.
You need people, entrepreneurs, people setting up companies to come into UK and pay their fair share of tax, but do so in such a manner that does not discourage wealthy people from coming.
But Julia Davis, an angel investor and co-founder of a group called Patriotic Millionaires UK, supports the change.
We've been sold quite a long time what I would say is a fairy story of trickle-down wealth, as in if there are some people that are doing incredibly wealthy in the UK, it's going to be good for everyone. But it hasn't turned out that way.
But while some wealthy people might leave, others could be attracted by that four-year tax break, says Joe Bateson, a tax lawyer at Mercer & Hole.
The new regime is really attractive for a kind of a typical entrepreneurial client. The UK is still a good place to be.
And Joe says it could also tempt Brits living abroad to move back home.
If I'm a Brit who has gone overseas with work or something, maybe living in America for 10 years, I can now come back to the UK and I can get the first 4 years under this regime.
So while some people will feel they're losing out, it may mean home sweet home for some homesick returnees. In the UK, I'm the BBC's James Graham for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.